I'm Dan Rodericks, and this is Midday. Atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. That's how 56 million Americans define their religious beliefs, according to a survey by the Pew Research Center. What's more, while the U.S. is still home to more Christians than any other country, the Christian share of the population is shrinking, dropping 8 percentage points since 2007. Today, a two-hour program on faith, or the declining amount of it, in the U.S. At noon, we discuss what's driving the trend away from religious affiliation. We'll hear from a professor of religion and politics, as well as a researcher who studies the role of religion in American life. And at 1, personal stories of faith. Open phone lines from Midday on Religion. Got faith? After the news from NPR. Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome back to Midday. Dan Rodericks here again. Thank you so much for joining us and making Midday part of your day. Should be interesting discussions on the show today. Well, I hope they're all interesting, but in particular, today we're going to be talking about religion and the decline of it. There was a survey out this year, Gallup did, finding that Americans' confidence in the church and organized religion generally has fallen dramatically over the past four decades, hitting an all-time low this year. And so we thought we'd talk about that. What's going on in the United States with disaffiliation, people turning away from organized religion, especially millennials, and what's up with that? So we're going to be doing that in this hour and next. And we hope you'll join us for that conversation because we'd like to get your insights on this and get your thoughts about it. So that'll be during this hour and next. But first, Fraser Smith is with us, WYPR senior news analyst, to talk about former Maryland Governor Marvin Mandel. Marvin Mandel was governor of Maryland 1969 to 1977 and then finished in 1979. It's a complicated story having to do with his corruption trial back in the 1970s. But he was 95 years old and died yesterday. And we didn't want to let this pass without talking about it a little bit with Fraser Smith. Nice to see you, Fraser.
Good to be with you, Dan.
Marvin Mandel, do you remember the first time you met him?
I do not. I got here just as his trials were ending. I got here in 1977, you know, and Blair Lee was the acting governor. And
wasn't that a strange time? We had
totally
a conviction of Governor Mandel and his five co-defendants in a big federal corruption trial, racketeering and mail fraud charges. And then he was out of office and Blair Lee the third took over. But then a three-judge panel of the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the conviction while Mandel still could serve as governor. So he came back into office for what, 45 hours?
And apparently
45 and a half hours.
Some of his old pals were running through the statehouse corridor shouting, "The boys are back,"
right?
You know, referring to, you know, the sort of ward healer proud name of a lot of these guys.
So the old Bahoys, B'HOYS.
Right.
Now, that was a strange time in Maryland. That's when I got here. I actually helped cover the first Mandel trial, which also was very weird. It ended with a mistrial because someone tried to tamper with a juror or the jury, and they never figured out who that was, who was behind that. Although two men were convicted for doing it, they would never say who put them up to it. The so-called shark, remains a mystery, whoever was behind that. But anyway, so Marvin Mandel, after all that, go ahead.
Well, I get a little confused, and I'm sure many do, about the chronology, because he ultimately did go to jail, and for 22 months he was in jail. Jimmy Carter, apparently, he and Mandel didn't get along, and Carter would not act. A lot of people would have released somebody like that earlier, and he wouldn't. And it turned out that Bruce Beriano, the lobbyist and close friend of the governor's for a long time, working with Mac Mathias, who was then a U.S. senator, got Ronald Reagan to release him.
To commute Marvin Mandel's sentence.
Right.
After 19 months, it was a three-year sentence. He was serving it at a federal prison camp at
Eglin
Air Force Base
in Florida.
But you're right. The Jimmy Carter problem goes back to, I think the primary of 1976 when Marvin Mandel, did he not support Jerry Brown?
They did. And you know, this was the organizational politics of yore. And they didn't particularly like Carter, I guess. And they just decided Irv Kovens, the old boss.
Political and godfather.
Money raiser, mm-hmm. decided that they would do it just basically just because they could, I think. So they Maryland ended up, or the Democrats ended up endorsing Governor Moonbeam, Jerry Brown.
You're right about the confusion of the case, because there was a conviction, there was a reversal, there was an affirmation, then he went to prison, then it was commuted, the sentence was commuted, but he did serve time. And then several years later, there was a Supreme Court ruling that led to another ruling a bit later that negated the sentence, where the sentences were thrown out, the convictions were thrown out.
I think he was convicted finally after changes of approach by the prosecutors, but I think he was convicted of denying the people of Maryland a good service.
Honest service.
A good and honest service, right. Yeah. And the question arose, well, was that really what Congress intended? And on that basis, he was released. And then they went back to Congress and said, was that really what you had in mind? And Congress said, yes.
So they
but
changed,
by then, he was
yeah,
gone.
By then, that okay. So we had that. And then he had this whole life after all of that. There was some quiet years there. And then he started appearing more in public. He was seen more in Annapolis all the time and served on the Board of Regents.
You know, there was clearly a difference that you and I would know between the image that the former governor had in Annapolis and the one that he had probably at large in the state. And sometimes they were the same. But I remember in the 80s doing a Marvin Mandela's back piece for The Sun, and I asked Paul Weisinghoff, a delegate from Baltimore, if he thought Governor Mandel had made a comeback. And Weisinghoff said, from where? I mean, this was after he had been in jail for 22 months.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, what he was saying was, as far as we're concerned, he didn't do anything wrong, and he's never been away.
Well, that was Paul Weisinghoff's perspective.
Well, it was, but I'm just saying, you know. And there are lots of people, of course, who think that, you know, he was convicted, but he was a great sort of engineer of government, and I think that's true. I think he had that, you know, the things that happened to him later in his life, he would have been really regarded as a sort of a refounding father.
He believed in good government. He was old school Democrat, New Deal Democrat, right?
Right.
But he was of the back room of Jack Pollock, Irv Kovens, the smoke filled back rooms.
Well, his origins. He basically became governor on the basis of one vote, because he was one vote on a 3-member central committee, and that had to replace. They had to replace somebody that had died or was gotten off.
Right. And that's how he became a delegate.
Right. And yeah. he voted for himself and convinced the other vote to vote for him.
And then he went on. He ended up being Speaker of the House in Maryland. And Spiro Agnew was governor. And then Spiro Agnew became Vice President of the United States with Richard Nixon. And Marvin Mandel was voted by the General Assembly to ascend and become governor.
Which was a slam dunk, because the votes were taken by the two houses.
Right.
And the Senate was for Billy James, a former senator from Harford County, I think. And but, you know, the Senate has 47 votes and the House has 147. Mm-hmm. So that was, that was never in question.
When you look at the charges against him, you know, we're talking about almost 40 years ago now, right? Despite all those things that happened post-conviction, the convictions being thrown out eventually, and then Congress taking another look at the mail fraud statute. But ultimately, do you believe Marvin Mandel did deprive the citizens of honest government? What's your take on it?
That's my impression. I was not here to hear the testimony in the trial, or to cover it, or to do anything like that, but you know, if you read Brad Jacobs' book about Mandel, Thimble Riggers, I mean, you know, the idea was that, yes, he had relationships with funders that even included the Catholic Church at some point.
Yeah, it was a very strange period of time. The governor, of course, even before he was indicted. That was the whole episode with his wife, where he announced that his wife of 32 years, that he was leaving her for a younger woman. The first lady, Barbara Bootsy Mandel, basically told him to leave. Well, he said he was leaving anyway, but she stayed in the mansion, and the governor took up residence in a hotel in Annapolis. And all that happened in 1973, 74. Then he was reelected in 74, so leaving his wife for another woman didn't seem to affect his popularity with voters.
Not at all.
Then the indictment came in 75, and then the two trials, first 76 and then 77. There was a lot of evidence that he had helped his friends, and the government put together more than a circumstantial case that he— did things in Annapolis to help his friends who had secretly purchased a racetrack in Prince George's County. And the legislature took actions that increased the value of that racetrack.
Right. And I think most people, or many people today, wouldn't understand the value of added or increased racing days. But it meant more revenue for the people that owned the track.
Right. And so the later years of Marvin Mandel, he was sort of rehabilitated in public. He became a member of the Board of Regents. Bob Ehrlich appointed him to that position, right?
Exactly. And he loved that, and he loved the University of Maryland, and he was really pretty rehabilitated. I mean, I think he didn't have a lot of money. I mean, he didn't get paid very much as governor, and then after that, he didn't have an opportunity to make any money. And so he kept serving as a lobbyist, with some hiccups along the way there as well. Mm-hmm. But this was the end of his life.
By the way, what was Marvin Mandel paid as governor? Do you know what his annual salary was?
I'm thinking it was in the area of 25.
It was $25,000. Eventually they raised it because the argument was, well, we have to take bribes because the governor will have to take bribes because he only makes $25,000. I think that was the Agnew argument.
You know, the other interesting thing to us, I think, about Marvin Mandel is his reputation as a storyteller. I mean, because he just loved to be involved in that part of the game. He told me at one point about advising Agnew about whether to make a speech on behalf of Rockefeller when in a Republican primary in which Richard Nixon was a candidate, and Marvin said to Agnew, who had gone from the school board chairmanship in Stoneleigh to vice president in, a very brief period of time. And so he didn't really, and Marvin thought he really didn't know politics very well. So he said to him, to Agnew, do you think Nixon will win? And Agnew said, yes, I do. And he said, do you think he'll forget that you made this speech? And he said, no. And then, finally, because of various things, he was taken on the Nixon ticket, and then Marvin Mandel became the governor.
Right. I remember Marvin Mandel on an interview saying the toughest decision he had to make as governor, Tropical Storm Agnes, 1972, and the gates at Conowingo Dam. Having to open additional gates so that the dam wouldn't burst, I guess, to release additional water that he knew would probably flood the town of Port Deposit. Remember that comment from the governor, from his time as governor. Marvin Mandel, we don't have information about funeral arrangements yet. The last thing I read on that was that they would be announced later this week, I believe. Anyway, Frazier, thank you very much.
Thank you, Dan.
We'll take a break here, and when we get back, folks, we'll begin our conversation about religion in Maryland and the United States. So please stay with us, and if you'd like to join the conversation, remember our phone number is 410-662-8780. Our toll-free long-distance number, 866-661-9309, and you can reach us by email midday@wypr.org. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here again. Our phone number, 410-662-8780. I'm going to give it a few times because I'd really like to get listener participation in this hour and next as we discuss religion. In May, the Pew Research Center put out its second comprehensive study on religion in the United States called America's Changing Religious Landscape. The U.S. Census does not ask about religion, so Pew surveyed 35,000 Americans to gather data about religious affiliation. It found that since its earlier survey in 2007, the percentage of adults who identify as Christian declined by about 8 percentage points, down to 70.6%. The Catholic population took a particular hit. Roughly 3 million fewer adults identified as belonging to the Catholic Church in this survey compared to 2007. About 56 million people described themselves as, quote, atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular. 56 million people. This group has grown by about 19 million since 2007, according to Pew. More than one-third of younger adults, those are the millennials that we'll be talking about in this hour and next, 18 to 26-year-olds, identify as religiously unaffiliated. Nearly one in five adults state that while they were raised with a particular faith, they now identify with no religion. Pew also found that the decline in Christian affiliation is not just occurring among millennials or people living outside of the Bible Belt. The trend was observed among all demographic groups and throughout the country. Among non-Christian faiths, Judaism, Hinduism, Islam, Buddhism, or other, there were only slight gains, up 1.2% since 2007, again, according to Pew. In this edition of Midday, we'll talk through what's driving the trend toward non-affiliation or disaffiliation. Why are millennials less religious than their parents? Is that true? Is the religious right turning people off to religion? Is the mixture of religion and politics a big turnoff for younger Americans? At one, we'll hear some personal stories of faith. What brings someone to church? What turns them away? And we hear how the rector of an Episcopal church here in Baltimore is working to keep people coming back. We'd like to welcome you to our show. Your comments on this, 410-662-8780. I'm joined in this hour by Jeffrey Lehman, a professor at the University of Notre Dame who studies religion and politics. Jeffrey Lehman, welcome to Midday on WYPR here in Baltimore.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And Daniel Cox is with us in the studio here in Baltimore, research director at the nonprofit, nonpartisan organization, the Public Religion Research Institute, the PRRI in Washington. The Public Religion Research Institute conducts research and surveys on the role of religion in American life. And Daniel Cox lives and breathes this stuff and has got some really interesting things to share with us about from his findings. So, Daniel Cox, welcome to Midday as well.
Great to be here.
So, I guess we begin with that question, why? And I'll just throw that out to Daniel Cox first and then Jeffrey Lehman. So you look at the numbers, the trends downward, the disaffiliation, non-affiliation. You wonder why. Why is this happening?
No, it's a great question, and it doesn't have any one answer. There's a number of reasons that that we've seen are sort of responsible for this rise in non-affiliation or disaffiliation, as you said. One of the things that we've really noted is that the religious backgrounds of millennials are different from previous generations. They're less likely to have been raised in religious homes, so they didn't participate as often as Xers or baby boomers in their religious services. They're less likely to pray or say grace with their family. And a whole variety of religious behaviors that begin in childhood, they were less involved in. And I think that sort of carries on into adulthood. And so that's sort of one really important factor. I think it hasn't been covered extensively.
So their parents, their parents might not have been churchgoers.
Well, it's partly the environment that they were raised in is very different. So millennials much more likely to be raised by divorced parents. Divorce rates topped out in the early 80s, and that's right at the cusp of the beginning of the millennial generation. Millennials were also much more likely to be raised in religiously mixed households. So households where mom might be Protestant, dad might be a Catholic, or maybe even, Jewish Muslim, that kind of religious combination. And we see in those types of family arrangements that they're less likely to be devout, to sort of subscribe to Orthodox religious beliefs. In fact, to even emphasize religious teachings when they're those kind of households. And so I think that's part of the mix as well.
We'll go to Jeffrey Lehman for my big why question. Jeffrey, go ahead.
Well, I would agree with what Daniel said, that there are multiple reasons for this, and it's hard to pin down any one. As a political scientist, my colleagues, David Campbell here at Notre Dame and John Green at the University of Akron, and I have focused on politics and particularly the rise of the Christian right. And before getting specifically into that, I think it's important to note that this increase in non-religion has been a rapid one in the United States, much more rapid than it's been in Europe or other advanced industrialized societies where we've seen this pattern of secularization over the last century or so. The United States was always thought to be the great exception to the pattern that modernization and industrialization produces secularization. But around 1990, the percentage of people calling themselves none or having no religious affiliation really takes off and is increased by leaps and bounds and continues to increase, as Pew and PRI have shown. And that takeoff point happens to coincide with really the real rise of the Christian right in American politics. It was around for about a decade before that. But that's really 1990 is really when it's in its heyday. Pat Robertson and the Christian Coalition were kind of at their pinnacle in terms of public perceptions and their strength within the Republican Party. And so we argue that, and we're not the first to argue this, other social scientists have argued this, we argue that the rise of the religious right, the increasing mixing of religion and politics, and particularly the mixing of religion and Republican and conservative politics, has turned people who might not share those political proclivities, who might be Democrats or independents or liberals or moderates, away from religion. And we find that while politics is not the most important thing moving people away from religion, it is important. And so this increasing mixing of politics and religion on one particular side of the political aisle has been a turnoff for many people. And I think that's especially true for millennials, but it's also important to note that this is not unique to millennials, that every age cohort in the United States has shown some increase in the percentage of people calling themselves non-religious. And so while millennials have been most turned off, I think there is some turning away by people in all generations, and partly due to the mixing of religion and politics.
Daniel Cox, back to you. I was struck by this piece that you wrote called "The Link Between Anti-Gay Church Teachings and the Millennial Exodus."
Yeah, so what Jeff is saying is very consistent with our own results. We found in a survey we conducted back in 2013 that one in three millennials who left their religion, so they became unaffiliated and were raised in religion, said that an important factor in their decision was the treatment of gay and lesbian people by churches. And so that's very much in the mix for this generation. And I think, importantly, the attitudes of this generation differs dramatically from previous generations. They're much more supportive of same-sex marriage, much more likely to know someone who's gay or lesbian. And that really informs their worldview and makes this issue much more real, I think, in some ways, than it does for older generations, previous generations that haven't had as much exposure on this issue.
You also write or report that the millennials aren't concerned about a perceived threat to religious liberty as, say, older Americans are.
Right. I think, you know, one of the real interesting things is the culture wars that, you know, we've been fighting in American politics for a generation really, you know, were the genesis of the baby boomers. And I think that there's a sense that millennials are much less likely to want to take up arms in battles over same-sex marriage or abortion, marijuana legalization, all these sort of cultural sort of flashpoints. And I think there's a sense that millennials are much more concerned about the economy, much more concerned about jobs, understandably, given their current economic situation. And just there's not sort of, you know, fire in their belly to sort of engage on these sort of hot button issues.
Can I ask you a couple of questions then? I was thinking about this today, and I was looking at Gallup surveys and the Pew survey, and I've seen other surveys about people's faith in institutions, their faith in the judiciary, their faith in Congress, their faith in the presidency, their faith in the news media, right? And it all seems, I'm sorry, but it all seems to be in decline. I don't know of any category, any of those categories they just mentioned, where it's been on the upswing. So does religion suffer from the same sort of dynamic that people are just, I don't know, more savvy today, more cynical about things in general? I'll go to you, Jeffrey Lehman, on that one.
Well, I think that's certainly true, and I think religion has also not helped itself in that regard. We've seen over this period of increasing non-religion, we've seen some fairly high-profile scandals within religion, and especially within Christian faith, and not just Catholicism, but within Protestantism as well. And we've seen that in the heyday of the Christian right, some high-profile scandals among televangelists and noted evangelical leaders. And that certainly has not increased confidence. And so I think, and in fact, in our own data, when we ask people what's the most important reason for leaving your old religion, having lost confidence in their religion's leaders is the most important thing. Politics comes in about third. But I think there's some interaction there that people are somewhat loosened from their old religious mores, and then they say religion getting mixed up in politics, and then they see these high-profile scandals. And I think that just sort of reinforces itself to suggest to them that religion may not be for them anymore. It may not be as important or relevant to their lives.
Daniel Cox?
Yeah, no, I think one of the real interesting things that's been occurring for, you know, a few decades now, this decline in public confidence in a whole array of institutions that you mentioned. I think maybe the military is the only one that has maybe increased or stayed level. But yeah, you look at the criminal justice system, police, government, organized religion, all fallen off and fairly precipitously. And I think you can't not look at the role of the internet really in the decline in this a little bit. And you're seeing increasingly people taking to blogs, comment space to critique. You know, you look at the media, you know, the rise of liberal and conservative blogs critiquing legacy media institutions. You're seeing the same thing happen on the web among, you know, gatherings of atheists. There's 2 million people on Reddit right now, or at least subscribers to atheist subreddits. So there's a community of atheists there, and a lot of what they're doing there is sharing their experiences, finding solidarity, but also critiquing organized religion. And there's a variety of these different forums now that didn't exist before the internet was around.
And it's not that's not an echo chamber.
No.
Right? I mean, that's just not 2 million atheists on Reddit talking to each other. That's on the internet for everybody to read.
Right. And you're seeing that, you know, the non-religious folks also, you know, on stories about religion commenting in threads. And so you're seeing their presence, their social presence is much, you know, more strongly felt. And it's not just online, too. I would say that you're seeing, like, the Secular Student Alliance, right? In 2003, this is a group that sort of promotes non-religious beliefs on college campuses. And there were less than 50 in 2003. By 2013, that number is around 350. So you are seeing sort of the institutional capacity increase for support for the people with these types of views. And I think that's certainly part of the story, at least one puzzle piece, I should say.
When you drill down a little bit into this, it sounds like Daniel Cox has, and Jeffrey Lehman has both. I have a question about spiritual religion versus traditional church-going religious faith. Do we see a distinction there among people who have fallen off, that they're still consider themselves spiritually religious but not affiliated with a church? I'll go to Jeffrey Lehman on that.
Well, yes, that group of people who call themselves spiritual but not religious has certainly increased in size, and I think that's probably much more prevalent among millennials than older generations, and so there is a continuing holding of some spirituality or some conventional religious belief, but not in the form of the organized church to the extent that it used to be. So going to worship services, being a member of a congregation, just isn't as important or as normative as it used to be. At the same time, I think you've also seen a rise in what my colleagues and I would call true seculars or active seculars, people who are not just simply non-religious or who have fallen off from faith, but are actively committed in a positive, affirmative way to secular, rationalist, humanist perspectives on the world. And that's a minority of this growing group of non-religious people, but it's a significant minority. It's a very active minority, and as Dan said, it's increasingly organized, both on the internet and in real places, in real gatherings and groups. And I think that is somewhat different from people who are just sort of hovering around faith, and as other people have shown, sort of move in and out of religion. And one month they might call themselves Methodist or Catholic or Presbyterian, and 6 months later they say no religion, and then they'll shift back and forth. I think we're starting to see this emerging group of true committed secularists, and that's important, I think, for both society and politics, as are the spiritual but not religious, but those are two very distinct groups of people.
Did you want to add to that, Daniel?
Yeah, no, I would say I, you know, agree with very much what Jeff was saying there. You know, we're seeing this rise of people who are, you know, actively, assertively secular. They are a minority, as Jeff mentioned, but they're becoming an increasingly part of the unaffiliated group. And this group is really an interesting one. You know, the atheist communities tend to claim them for themselves and say, oh, look at all these non-believers. And, of course, only a minority of the unaffiliated are atheists. But on the other side, you're seeing, you know, pastors or religious leaders saying, well, these are folks that just have lost their way, but they'll eventually be coming back. But, you know, as Jeff said, and as the research shows, that a lot of these folks are sort of committed secular. Religion is just not something they think about. It's not important. And, you know, when you ask them, well, is there a likelihood that you're coming back? Most of them say no. So it's not a group that I think that, you know, is likely to come back in the near future.
Daniel Cox is research director at the Public Religion Research Institute in Washington. And joining us by phone is Jeffrey Lehman, a professor of politics, American politics, and he studies religion and politics at the University of Notre Dame. I want to take a couple of calls from our listeners before we go to our next break here and invite others to join us with their observations and thoughts about this. I could ask many questions. I could ask, do you identify as atheist, agnostic, or nothing in particular? Do you follow the same faith as your parents or grandparents did? Have you fallen off? Do you feel guilty about that? Do you have second thoughts or regrets about it? And do you have a struggle with your children at home about religion and how to raise them? 410-662-8780. Craig Gould is director of youth and young adult ministries at the Archdiocese of Baltimore, and he called in to add to this conversation. Craig, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to say, Craig?
One thing I thought was important is to put the conversation within the context of the crisis of the community that young adults experience in general. We're finding, you know, it's really redefining what it means to be in community, to be part of community. They experience high fluctuations in the community that they're a part of. And I think as Professor Cox mentioned earlier, the internet has part to do with that. The Reddit community he mentioned, you know, is a community of online folks. And so I think everywhere from marriage to religious institutions, we're seeing that change in how people define themselves as part of communities and what communities they are a part of. So I think it's good to have that conversation for religious institutions within the larger conversation of how millennials experience community in general.
Okay. Well, in this case, more of them are not experiencing a religious community. That's what polls indicate.
Right. The statistical evidence is there that they're not experiencing a religious community. But the question then becomes, like, I think religious communities have suffered from a lack of trying to engage young adults around the idea of community in general. Mm-hmm. I think young adults experience community in much different ways. It's no longer simply geographical like it used to be. And I think that's where religious communities kind of always had their bread and butter. They assumed people who lived close by were going to engage in community in their geographical areas, and churches are even established as such. And especially within the Catholic Church, think of themselves as being engaged around a geographical community, and yet the internet and other forms of communication have allowed young people to experience community beyond the scope of just
right.
who's close to them.
Right, virtually, yeah.
a virtual community, right? I get you. I get what you're saying, Craig. Daniel, have you ever thought about that?
Yeah, well, one of the really interesting things about this increase of unaffiliated folks is that, you know, the religious habits, the religious beliefs that begin in childhood, you know, that's where people really learn about what religious community is, and through their parents and family members, they're brought to church. But one thing that I think is important to note, particularly about this group of millennials who are unaffiliated now, they're much more likely to marry someone who's also unaffiliated today than they were a generation ago. So looking at the general social survey, you know, and analysis that's done in the 1970s, you find only a minority, I think it's like around 4 in 10 Americans who were unaffiliated married someone who was also unaffiliated.
Hmm.
By the 2010s.
It was much higher?
Yeah, it's a majority. It's now 60%. So if you're unaffiliated, you're more likely to marry someone who's also unaffiliated.
Yeah. Jeffrey, you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think those are all very good points. I think especially if you think about American religion in comparison to this long decline in religion that we've seen in Europe that I mentioned before, one of the explanations for why religion was so strong here, remains so strong here, whereas it didn't in other similar societies, is sort of what the caller said, that religion was able to provide a sense of community in a nation of immigrants and also a very transient society. When people moved to the U.S. or when they moved within the U.S., religion provided that sense of belonging and community. And it doesn't as much anymore. There are alternative communities that have sprung up both on the internet and in real places. And I think also on marriage, another thing to remember is that inter-religious marriage has also increased to a great extent. And so that reinforcement that comes from marrying somebody of the same faith or the same denomination and families coming together, extended families who are all belong to the same faith, that has disappeared to a large extent as well. And so even if you're marrying somebody who's also religious, they may not be the same denomination. They may not even be in the same faith tradition as you. And that tends to have sort of potentially damaging effects on religious faith, and you may look to other things for community and belonging.
Theo in Hamden, holding to make a comment before we take our break here. Go ahead, Theo.
Yeah, hi. I've noticed one thing in my neighborhood, Hamden-Woodbury, an area that was immersed in religiosity and institutions like the Methodist Church. Four or five buildings, I mean actual church buildings, have disappeared, and they've been replaced by businesses, and nobody seems to lament that. So I think that's a little indication of what's going on, that perhaps the spirituality continues, but the organizations are getting weaker. I would like to say two other things, though. I think Bill Maher is helping the atheist cause. He makes it cool to be an atheist. And one last thing, I do a lot of work around the Washington suburbs, and I'll tell you one thing, when your religion is challenged, that's when your religion and even the need for a building increases. For example, Egyptian cops, a recent arrivals in the United States, they've been so challenged in Egypt that the first thing they do when they arrive in America is work hard and build a building where they can observe their faith.
Yeah.
So that's my observation.
Right. Well, that would explain the diversity. The loss of churches, population in the cities, that's partly a measure of loss of city population, but also disaffiliation as well. So anyway, this is not unusual for us to see parishes closing down in cities anymore.
Yeah, no, that caller's comments really resonated with me. So I used to live in Adams Morgan in D.C., and there's this great big old church right on Columbia Road. It's not being knocked down, but they're changing it into a hotel. And I'm sure it's going to be one of those nice high-end boutique hotels, and I'm sure there'll be more millennials going to that hotel bar than there would be in a worship service there. The other thing that I think that the caller mentioned that's really important as well, you're actually seeing increasingly atheist characters on TV. And I don't know how cool they are, but characters like Alicia Florrick and The Good Wife, very popular shows, and her atheism is actually part of her character, and they build it into the plot lines. And I think that's really important because atheism and atheists have actually been stigmatized to a great degree in this country, and I think that's actually changing a little bit. They still remain much more viewed much more negatively than, say, Catholics or Protestants, but the sort of attitudes about atheists are softening a little bit.
We'll have to take a little break here, Daniel. We'll come back. Daniel Cox from the Public Religion Research Institute in Washington, and by phone, Jeffrey Lehman at the University of Notre Dame. Our conversation about religion will continue in a moment. Did you grow up religious and lose faith somewhere along the way? And has politics and religion turned you off from an organized church? We'd like to hear from you. Please feel free to join us, 410-662-8780. Here's an email from Frank in Hampstead, Maryland. It says, I was raised in an Irish Catholic household. However, I and the Catholic Church have reached a parting of the ways. The Catholic Church today has strayed far from the concepts of Vatican II and become more reactionary and backward instead of moving forward. In addition, all the scandals that have been hidden for years, the church-state linkage in Ireland, pedophilia, etc. While I believe in the God of Catholic faith, I feel that I have moved beyond what the Catholic Church is teaching and believing now. I feel God can be found anywhere, not just in church. You do not need a place to find him. Thank you, Frank. If I could speak to Frank, I would ask the question I would ask Jeffrey Lehman. Is Pope Francis making a difference when it comes to falling off Catholics? Do we have any sense of that yet, Jeffrey?
I'm not sure if we have any sense of that yet. Dan may know that better than I do from a data standpoint, but I think Pope Francis is certainly changing the tenor and the impression of the Catholic Church in a way that is more favorable to American millennials, most likely, and would be much more in tune with Vatican II. And I think for Vatican II, Catholics would be much more attractive. On the other hand, it's a double-edged sword because Pope Francis is a controversial figure among traditionalist Catholics, and so there may be, a number of Catholics who like a more conservative or traditionalist brand of the faith, and they find, as we've heard some Republican presidential candidates say, they find this Pope maybe delving a little bit too much into the secular and the political in ways that they find to be maybe moving beyond the core teachings of the church. And so it's always a double-edged sword, but I do think Pope Francis has put a more modern more modern face on the church and more in keeping with probably the ideals of millennials, who are a little less concerned about same-sex marriage and even abortion and more concerned about social and economic justice and the environment and things like that. I think they probably like this Pope quite a bit better than the last Pope.
You know, I threw that question to Jeffrey Lehman because he's out at the University of Notre Dame, so I'm sorry. But Daniel Cox, I don't know if you have any data on that yet.
Yeah, we just actually released a poll last week looking at the
Francis effect.
Yeah, exactly. You know, question mark. I think the verdict is still very much out on that. If you want to measure it by increased attendance and increased Catholic identity, there's nothing to support that yet. However, we did find that a majority of Catholics said since Pope Francis was elected that they did change their attitude towards the church, and it was overwhelmingly positive than negative. Hmm. Whether that translates into any more sort of substantial activity or commitment to the church, I think remains to be seen.
Go ahead, Jeff.
Just to chime in, I was just going to say a lot of this, I think, has to do with millennials and a lot of people who are not millennials finding the church or religion in general just not to be that relevant. And I think Pope Francis has certainly made the Catholic Church more relevant on mm-hmm. the world stage to issues that millennials care about. And so even if it may not increase mass attendance in the short run, I think it does mean that he is a figure that they find to be relevant for things that they care about in a way that maybe the church had not been for a little while.
I think he's right about that. You could do a survey question would be,
are you more likely to pay attention to a news story about Pope Francis than you were the earlier popes, the last two popes? There's a question for you, Daniel Cox, for your next survey. Here's a comment from Matt. He says, a big reason I stopped being religious about 15 years ago, around the age of 15, is that I realized there is nothing you can do with religion that cannot be done without religion. Using religion as a reason or vessel for doing good things, such as donating, feeding the homeless, or praying for someone's well-being, is an archaic idea. I recently saw a group of suburban housewives selling T-shirts at a local Chick-fil-A after the riots in Baltimore, which said, pray for Baltimore. I said to my wife, I wish that the T-shirt said, volunteer for Baltimore. Brantz in Towson wanted to make a comment. Hello, Brantz.
Hello.
Go right ahead. What did you want to say?
Well, basically, when thinking about millennials, I'm not a millennial, but a little older than that. But I was raised in a very strict religious world, Mormonism. Moved to Baltimore a while after. But I find that science, and the more we learn, the more we become aware of the actual scientific facts of things, the harder it is to rectify, I guess, the dogma and the lore of the book, 6,000 years of the age of the earth, for example. And so I wonder if maybe that has something to do as well as the politics with the outflow of people going to church.
Hmm. Anyone want to comment on that?
Well, I actually want to comment on the email.
On the email?
Yeah, that you just read.
You can do anything without the premise of religion.
Yeah, right? Well, that's actually sounds like a paraphrased Christopher Hitchens line, which he used to give, and he had these debates with religious leaders, and he used to challenge them and say, name me one moral action that a religious person can engage in that an atheist cannot, and obviously there was never a response to that.
That sounds like a stump, yeah.
and so I think that email sort of is reflecting that basic idea.
Go ahead. Science.
I could respond to the caller. Yeah. I think there's certainly a lot of truth to that, and from a social scientific standpoint, that's probably the leading explanation for why Europe has become so secular, is that science and modern life provide explanations and provide things that religion used to provide. And we're not as susceptible to the vagaries of weather and things like that in a modern society. The United States, though, is always somewhat immune to that, and so I think that's important. At the same time, it's important to remember that the brand of Christian faith, at least, that challenges science, challenges global warming, holds to traditional biblical principles, is evangelicalism, and it's actually it's not increasing like it was in the past, but it's not suffering the decline that mainline Protestantism and even Catholicism is, at least not to the extent. And so it's still holding fast. And so I think the caller's right about science. At the same time, religions that are actively sort of challenging science seem to still have probably more adherence than those who have chosen a more secularized path.
Dan, I would just say one thing, and that is I think we may not have seen the evangelical decline yet. Mm-hmm. I think we're on the cusp of actually seeing we're talking about white evangelical Protestants, which is who we usually refer to when we talk about that group. And why just right, we haven't seen a dramatic drop-off, as much as the mainland Protestants. If you look at the age differences between millennials and seniors, only 10% of millennials are white evangelical Protestant, compared to more than 1 in 4 seniors. So you're really seeing a really stark generational divide in that group.
Listen, we're out of time for this hour. We're going to continue the conversation into the next hour, though. But I want to thank our guests here in the first hour of midday, Jeffrey Lehman, professor at the University of Notre Dame, who studies religion and politics, and Daniel Cox, who serves as research director at the nonprofit Public Religion Research Institute in Washington. You can find a link to his article on millennials and church teachings on gay rights, on gays, on the Dan Roderick's Facebook page. Jeffrey Lehman, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
And Daniel Cox, thank you for coming up from D.C. to be with us for this discussion.
My pleasure.
We'll take a break here, folks, for lunch brought to us today for our guest by Rosina Gourmet. Rosina Gourmet is located in Canton, downtown Baltimore, and Harbor East. Catering is available by visiting rosinagourmet.com. Another hour ahead, so if you are on the line, please stand the line or call us back after the news.